or you can go to it online.
More and more apparent, and they're running more and more desperately toward their finish line. Tonight's show is our guests are going to be Steve Yates and Dr. Steve Yates. Our second hour is going to be a rebroadcast of his last summer's show entitled Phony Free Trade. You know, in that one, Professor Yates discussed the real effect and purpose of global trade agreements. He explained how these phony free trade agreements are designed to undermine national sovereignty, establish regionalism, and feed the global governance monster while destroying the vision of the American experience. And it's a powerful show, so even if you heard it in August, it's worth hearing again, particularly after you hear our opening live show, which is going to be a discussion on how free enterprise is being destroyed in the emerging public-private partnership economy that America's seeing coming down itself so quickly. Well, Roy, I'm looking forward to tonight's show and putting on the heels of the Terry Hayfield week last week. And
a lot has happened between last week and this week.
That's true. And I remember well what Patrick Wood had to say about the port deal and that 2 weeks ago. And then, gee whiz, Erica Carl before that and Charlotte Isabeat. It has been just a bang-up lineup of people that the Americans long so much to hear from, because these are people who give it straight down the line and tell us what's true and what we need to understand and recognize. And it all ties together so well, don't you think?
Oh, it's everywhere, you know. Sometimes, after doing this, we keep kind of talking about the same things, but it is the same thing, just with, you know, a different color or a different twist to it in every part of our lives.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, we announced last week, it's worth doing it again, the new initiative, the People's Initiative in the state of California called Limit Eminent Domain. And you can get information how to get and download Ellis Rowe, who is the chairperson for this from the city of San Jose. And wow, have they got a dynamite organization, a clean, clear constitutional amendment to the California Constitution that keeps any government from taking your home or your land or your business and giving it to their buddy developers, the public-private partnership dynamic, so that they can share in some profits. And this is happening in so many states across the nation. If you're listening to us and you're not from California, I'd say go find out what's happening in your state, because this is a bandwagon that everybody can jump on. You know, no private property, there'll be no free expression. No free expression, we just all become drones of a community state. And also, don't forget, if you haven't gone to Stewards of the Range, go there to sign the Repeal the Endangered Species Act. That's stewards.us to do just that. We'll be right back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station, and before we bring our guest tonight, Dr. Stephen Yates, on the line, there's one matter, I think, Roy, of some interest to certainly the local listeners, but it has application to everybody, because this is what's going on everywhere. Here in Santa Cruz, the government's dissemination of Freedom 21 projects is just increasing at an ever-rapening rate. The Board of Supervisors is having a compatibility ordinance where the government can look at any design to your house and determine whether or not it's compatible with the neighborhood. And this is a totally outrageous ordinance with definitions that are quite quite humorous, actually. But there's a reaction coming from the citizens of Santa Cruz as against this. It also would take houses and eliminate portions of their lot for determining lot size, and the effect of that would be that your house becomes non-conforming in the event of a desired remodel or a catastrophe. So it's just another grab on private property. You know, it's so many by ordinance this way are coming. It's like the thousand points of darkness just coming, and here comes another one. But I think people are starting to figure it out. And then up in a little mountain community called Felton, they're bringing a government apartment project up there. They're breaking all their own rules to get this there with their favorite little developer, South Coast Housing. Boy, I saw their tax return this week, Roy, and it's amazing what these nonprofits can do in terms of collecting government revenue to subsidize their inefficient activities at all about a 2.5-to-1 ratio. It's just remarkable.
And they get all this money, and the government cries that there is no money.
Well, there's no money because, they can't print it fast enough to hand it out to all these nonprofit Agenda 21 implementers who are nothing but, quote, the public-private partners that we're going to talk about here tonight. So if you're in Santa Cruz, understand it's rolling at you from a lot of directions right now. We're going to have more discussions on that. And if you're not in Santa Cruz,
it's coming at you.
Watch our pattern, because it's either there already or it's being built very quickly. The business councils and the public-private partnerships, along with the environmentalist regulation makers. And the whole squeeze is to restructure our society from top to bottom. And this can be stopped, but I think it's only going to be stopped if people see what the real problem is. And we stop fighting these phony little battles on the sideline.
Right, because when your mayors go to the mayor's meetings and your governors go to the governor's meetings and your city council people go to their League of Cities meetings, they're just all being trained to implement these programs.
Well, that's right. And we had cause today to give the Planning Commission the Understanding Sustainable Development Guide. So we'll see what that does. Well, welcome back here to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. During that break, Roy and I were discussing some Santa Cruz local issues. And anytime you don't hear the entire Freedom 21 Santa Cruz show or you miss an episode, you can go to our radio archives, go to our website and tune into those archives, and boy, there's just some great audio material there. And
it's better than a college education, I think.
Well, it's
because it's real.
It's been more insightful and it's been more exciting than any class that I attended. And I'm just so pleased that the people who have become our guests exist, because boy, for a while sitting here on the side of the country, I didn't know that there were so many really serious people concerned about liberty and who didn't fall for some of these dialectic traps that it's so easy for any of us to fall into because they're so cleverly designed.
And speaking of professors,
Hello,
Stephen Yates.
Well,
how is everybody?
We are fine. We've sort of done a little rundown on federal, state, and local, and I think we're ready to talk about what public-private partnerships are and why it is that the average American needs to be concerned about it.
Well, one thing I heard you say is reference to Santa Cruz. I can certify that this is not just a Santa Cruz, California thing. These entities, or whatever you want to call them, are everywhere. Now, I live in Greenville, South Carolina, and public-private partnerships are all over the place.
Give some examples.
In this area. Sure, I'll give you a good example. There's a large facility being built. It's close to the interstate that it's called ICAR. It's called the, if I can get this name right, the International Center for Automotive Research. There you go. It involves federal government, state government, so there's the public side.
Now what and is also, the federal also government doing in your town, North Carolina? South Carolina. With my funds to partner up with someone to create a global idea of how to build a car. That isn't what I thought I elected a congressman for.
Well, no. It also involves Clemson University, which is the largest public university in this area, and it involves several corporations, including, of all people, Microsoft. Notice how the government's gotten off their backs lately. But anyway, that's another conversation. And it involves BMW and I think Ford Motor Company, but don't hold me to that one. But there's several corporations involved, mostly very high-tech kind of stuff.
Well, you know, that confirms again what Patrick Wood had to say on this show several weeks ago when he mentioned that the trilateral arrangement is between business, government, and academia on a trilateral global basis, that is Europe, Asia and America. And boy, you just kind of hit the nail on the head with that example of what he described in concept for us.
And this concept is all the rage around here. It is underway. It's in the planning phases. And if you can look at the website, which I think is just www.icar.com, because it could be .org, I'm not sure, but you'll see all of this laid out, and there's definitely sustainability type of notions there. There's things like a wildlife preserve being talked about and everything else like that.
In connection with the
In connection with the partnership.
The partnership is
one of the things that's being... that's being put together out there.
Yeah, well, what does a wildlife preserve have to do with cars?
Nothing, but it has everything to do with sustainable development.
Well, you know, the costs continue to roll up as these kinds of offshoots are being conducted by business, supposedly bringing product to the consumer, and particularly when they're so subsidized by the government. But let's get to a deeper issue, Stephen, with regards to the whole philosophy behind public-private partnerships. I mean, when I begin to describe this to most people, they end up saying, well, that's fascism, isn't it?
Well, yeah, in a way it is. You know, it's kind of sort of like the fascism that dare not speak its name, if you catch my drift.
Sure, it wouldn't sell if it was called that.
True.
Sustainable development would not sell if it was called what it really is. And
no, here they call it Vision 2025. I understand from a correspondent of mine that Vision 2025 is also used in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's for essentially the same thing, and a couple of other places, too, using a vision something or other, usually some year in the future after that. Vision 2020, I've encountered that one, although I forget where. But in any regard, you asked about the philosophy behind public-private partnerships. A few weeks ago, I ran across a phrase, can't remember now where I got it, I think it goes way back, but the power of the purse combined with the power of the sword. Now, the power of the purse is essentially money power, the power of business, and particularly large businesses with very deep pockets. The power of the sword, of course, that's the power of the state, the power of government, to pass laws, give subsidies, give tax breaks, and whatever other incentives it takes to lure the businesses into the partnership. And what they tell the public is that this creates jobs. And in the short term, I suppose it does.
But in the long term?
But in the long term, well, you mentioned fascism. In the long term, of course, it's building an edifice of controls around everybody, including people who are innocently pulled into it, either by the lure of jobs or businesses get involved in these things because they see it as profitable, and in the short term it probably is.
Well, what I see continually happening is a process of taking the table at which business at which public-private partners sit. And the goal of the philosophy behind public-private partnership would be to cause that table to continue to shrink. In other words, to continue to centralize power. So those guys who go rushing up to the table as public-private partners end up serving the interests on the short term because it knocks out free enterprise, it would seem to me. And but over time, the public-private partners get greedier and greedier, and the smaller ones of them continually drop out until we really have a very centralized economic system working on a global to local basis. And, of course, that's when everybody is subject to total control, because otherwise you don't eat.
Well, yeah, it's all about progressive centralization, gradualist, Fabian-type methodology, bringing about first centralization at the local level, then at the regional level, and then eventually at the global level.
Well, it's becoming more and more apparent that the force of government and the power of business are being combined really to the harm of the notions of an American experience. That's my read. Is that how do you react to that?
Well, the advocates of public-private partnerships have a real rosy picture of them as free market friendly. Now, I could just read you from a white paper published by one of the main national organizations, called the National Council for Public-Private Partnerships. Here's what it says, and I'm quoting, "Public-private partnerships are a means of utilizing private sector resources in a way that is a blend of outsourcing and privatization. PPPs can involve the design, construction, financing, operation and maintenance of public infrastructure or facilities, or the operation of services to meet public needs. PPPs are often financially freestanding, that is, privately financed and operated on the basis of revenues received for the delivery of the facility and or services." I'm not saying, end of quote, I'm not saying this is great writing or anything, but but you get the you get the drift of the combination here of government and business to make policy. And there may be a third ingredient, one which Joan Vion talks about, government, business, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which can be large or small foundations. And if somebody can, for example, pull in a Ford Foundation grant or something like that, you're talking about people with very deep pockets.
Oh, Ford, Irvine, Hewlett-Packard.
Packard Foundation is another big one. Well, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation now. Mm-hmm. I understand they just gave some money to UNESCO.
I read about
that. Don't you just love that?
Well,
like I said, the government's not on their backs anymore, if you noticed.
Well, the Fabian motto has always been that you encourage, in the earlier stages of this economic transformation, you encourage free enterprise so that you can find those free enterprises that will become compliant, and you can separate out those who will not be compliant. So they look up for some talent, and let's suppose they found a guy named Bill Gates who with talent, and they brought him into his web, and he now qualifies for the high priest in the Comtean context of the Earth's future. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our guest Stephen Yates. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and we're going to go right through this commercial break for the audiences that don't split off. So, Stephen, let's keep talking about how this is all coming to pass. I know that there has been circulated fairly widely this last week a letter by the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and this was published in the Taipei Times, way over in Taiwan. This is the American Council on Foreign Relations. And I find it one of the most extraordinary, it must be a 300-word essay that I've probably ever read in my life. I know you've seen it. What are your thoughts? Maybe you can describe it a bit for our audience.
Well, let's see. I encountered it for the first time Friday morning, I think it was. Just somebody had forwarded to me. It turned up in my email, and I just gasped when I read it. I think my response was the same as yours. Well, one thing I thought of was something that the scholar Cleon Skousen said long ago. Cleon Skousen, the author of The Naked Communist, which is a true history of the rise of Marxism, and also The Naked Capitalist, which is sort of like a book-length book review of Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. But anyway, he said something along the lines of that as the global elite came closer and closer to achieving their goal, what they were doing would gradually become more and more obvious, and at the end all the veils would drop away and they would have to, and they would run naked to the finish line.
Naked
that's not
to
a
the finish
quote,
line.
That's
well,
a paraphrase.
You know, I can tell you, I think that's happening around around town, Roy. And you know, and every time I look at Schwarzenegger, I look at a desperado, you know, without a horse. And of course, Bush is somewhat in the same regard. That police state just keeps bubbling up under his nose wherever he goes.
You know, Blizzard, there's this strange idea that George W. Bush is a conservative. Even a Christian conservative.
Well,
I guess that's government schools.
Well, I think that to a well intentioned not well intentioned to a liberal with goodwill toward men, he'd probably say, well. You can't call some of these liberals genuine liberals. You know, the problem is that America's got leadership on the left and on the right, both of whom are taking us down this path to political globalism.
Well, yeah. If you look at the last several presidential administrations, really all the way back to Truman, which is a little bit before my time, yours too, I think, you find both Democrats and you find Republicans, but you don't really, what you don't find is any significant difference in the direction that the country is taking.
Well, that's what we certainly see with the Agenda 21 policies. It hasn't mattered whether it was Bush, Clinton, or Bush, and it's not going to matter who the next president is. You know, the goal has to be the time after that, but that's a short time to wake people up, because the Agenda 21 program's coming hard, it's coming fast, it's on every aspect of life, and it is in your town. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, and our special guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Yates. We're discussing public-private partnerships, and really the broader economic and the deep-seated moral issues that arise with the framework of organizing society around public-private partnership. You know, Steve, it seems to me that public-private partnership is it's the system that nurtures corruption. You know, the whole system of checks and balances, which is so natural to a free enterprise system, is going just as fast as free enterprisers are. And you know, what I smell growing in its wake is a rapid increase in the corruption that comes from having certain individuals buddy up as insiders with the people with government power. Do you see public-private partnerships that way?
Pretty much. I certainly see them as breaking down the long-standing checks and balances that a free society really needs in place. Like business having certain entirely legitimate aims and objectives, and government has a different set of aims and objectives. To encode our rights and serve as the medium to protect our rights, whereas business exists to make a profit by providing a legitimate service or a legitimate product. Either one can overstep its bounds, you might say, because this is just human nature. Behind this, nothing necessarily against government by itself, or necessarily against business by itself. It's just human nature. So we need checks and balances. Now, when the two start working together, government and business, the end result is going to be, like we talked about earlier, is going to be kind of a homegrown soft fascism, to use a term I've caught myself using recently.
Well, I think that's a good term. Let's go back a little bit to the discussion of the letter that outlined the globalists' objectives here, written by the president of the American Council on Foreign Relations, just on February 21, 2006, in the Taipei Times. You know, he basically says in his first paragraph that sovereignty has been the organizing principle. State sovereignty has been the organizing principle of international relations. He then comes, quote, to say, the time has come to rethink this notion. And I was just shocked by his display of directness when he described the events, the issues of the world today that are being used to cause the termination of national sovereignty and the establishment of a global government. And to give an example of that is that he even talks about sovereignty having to be ceded in order to address the threat of global climate change. Well, by reading it, it says, well, gee whiz, so that's the purpose of global climate change. It's to help them produce the circumstance by which public-private partnerships become, and world government become, the organizing principles of tomorrow.
Well, yeah, of organizing principles of the economic side of the whole thing. In order to have a brand of capitalism that is managed, controlled, as you said earlier, they identify the players who will cooperate. And those are the ones who get the tax breaks, the other incentives, whatever they need. And the lone wolf types are the ones who lose out. And we shouldn't be naive about these corporations, who haven't really believed in the free market system since John D. Rockefeller Sr. called competition a sin.
Well, we've certainly seen the growth and centralization of economic power in certain corporations, and remarkably, those corporations tend to line up as agents of change, sustainable development change, and one has to begin to wonder if not their purpose is to protect the power that they feel being weakened and perhaps undermined by their own economic system. So those are the kinds of interesting questions that lie behind this issue of public-private partnership, and we're going to be back here in a few seconds with our guest Stephen Yates. Remember, for more information on these kinds of subjects, go to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and we're going to continue talking about public-private partnership. And, you know, Roy, let me ask you, you see public-private partnership over the hill in Silicon Valley? Is that a dominant thing over there?
You know, not only is it dominant, and it's, you know, in every part of business. But where it scares me the most is in the educational system of the public-private. I mean, there's a, I don't know, four different organizations who work with the government and local industry to basically dictate what happens in the schools.
Wow. Local government and industry dictating the principals in Silicon Valley.
There's school to work, and, you know, there's just all these different kinds of programs that are going on there that are just incredible.
Well, of course, that takes the subject of public-private partnership right into the realm of where people like Michael Chapman at EdWatch are working, and of course that's been a consistent theme that they've pointed out to us as well. And Steve, do you have any sense about an awakening on campus at the universities about the threat posed with this third way privatization, public-private partnership dynamic?
Not as such. In fact, I'm just the opposite. I detect a lot of enthusiasm about it, which is since I work in a couple of colleges, and one of them is a tech college. It's a little bit depressing, actually. I've formulated in one of my manuscripts in progress, there's really two basic philosophies of education, and the real Cold War in education has been between those two. One of them is the classical model, which sets out to produce an educated citizen, informed thinking citizen, who understands something about history, knows something of his or her own heritage, so has the knowledge and usually the will to criticize those in power when they need it. The other school of education is the vocational model, and education is sufficient if it gives a person job skills and a career. And the latter is winning hands down in the secondary schools, especially the government schools, and also community college and technical college. Technical colleges is what they call them in South Carolina, community colleges elsewhere, but most of those institutions are vocational.
Excuse me there, Stephen. We're back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our guest, Stephen Yates. And during the break, we were discussing the philosophy of public-private partnerships and how it's affecting school systems from Silicon Valley to Santa Cruz to South Carolina and all places in between, and how this is driving us toward raising children without a classical information education based on information and facts, but toward a vocational training gearing people as components to the New World Order workforce.
The global workforce.
The global workforce. You know, I've quoted it often on this show, but our local high school, a brand new one, has a principal who announces that the purpose of the school is to train global citizens. So, you know, those in education, I'd say without taking cognizance of what they're saying, are playing right into this public-private partnership, a global fascist dynamic that breaks apart the sovereignty of all nations simply in order to establish this global-to-local network of total human control called Agenda 21.
And they're running after younger and younger kids all the time. Here in the state of California, there's a big program called First Five, you know, and they want to get kids into the program, you know, early on.
Well, they want to get them out of the hands of the parents, and that's been the disappointing thing, and yet something of great opportunity for us, and that is that when homeowners realize that their homes are under attack, and when business people understand their business is under attack, the concept of free enterprise, and when parents understand that parenthood is under attack because the goal is to create these little compliant individuals to the dictates of a new world order that put them in a work job that suits the community and not that necessarily has any suitability to their own personality and their own nature. So it's the parents who stand up and say, well, we're just not going to participate in that anymore, and we're going to take charge of the rearing of our children, including putting them in the hands of people, ourselves or others, who can give them the kinds of information that used to be found in community schools predicated on a classical educational basis. And maybe even that might begin to reemerge as the times move on and people begin to smell more and more that something's wrong. It's great that this port deal's having so much trouble. Of course, the reasons why it is may be more complex than what's readily apparent. But nonetheless, as Patrick Wood said a few weeks ago, if this deal goes down and the public doesn't react to it, well, we're on our way to the global corporate state that is so much a part of political globalism.
Since you mentioned him, Patrick Wood has a new article up on his website, the August Review.
Yes.
It's brand new. I have not had a chance to look at it yet, even.
Well, I'm sure our listeners...
But it addresses this very thing.
Well, I'm going to look at it tomorrow because... he offers a lot to this subject. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I've only had a chance to glance at it in between classes that I teach.
Well, if you are interested in seeing this writing from Mr. Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, we have a link to it on our radio page. You link the link at the bottom of the description of tonight's shows, and it will take you to this Taipei Times article that outlines the reasons and the methodologies that are being used to bring us to world government. A very forthright expose. Interesting that, of course, it was not published here in the United States.
Yeah, the only place to find it in the U.S. that I know of is on the Council of Foreign Relations' own website. I was able to find a slightly different version there, just under the title Sovereignty and Globalization.
Well, very interesting.
It's not identical, but it's essentially the same article, and argues the same thesis that, for all practical purposes, as far as they're concerned, national sovereignty is history. Mm-hmm. It's in their way. In other words, and so late in the article, he says, let me just read this. Our notion of sovereignty must therefore be conditional, even contractual, rather than absolute. If a state fails to live up to its side of the bargain by sponsoring terrorism, either transferring or using weapons of mass destruction or conducting genocide, then it forfeits the normal benefits of sovereignty and opens itself up to attack, removal, or occupation. Now note there that he's treating all nation states as essentially equivalents. Now, I'd be the first to admit that there are some nation states out there whose sovereignty I wouldn't be interested in preserving necessarily, but the United States of America is not one of them. Now, some people believe we had a good thing going here at one time. Constitution, government by consent of the governed, limited government, private property rights, rule of law, and a few other things along those lines. And if national sovereignty goes, all of that goes too, in favor of the world of sustainable development, environment, equity, economy. And it's all about control.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I always go back to the difference between the U.S. Declaration of Independence and how it contrasts with the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights. And, it's clear when one thinks about these two documents that the purpose of government under the two is exactly the opposite.
Oh, sure.
Under the Constitution, it says that Congress will make no law. And what it says under the UN Declaration of Human Rights, this world government that is being talked about in this context, and
the UN Declaration of Human Rights also contains remarks like these rights may not be exercised in ways that are in conflict with the goals and aims of the United Nations.
Yeah, precisely. So whoever it is that's behind the UN, and it's not Kofi Annan, whoever it is that's behind the UN is going to call all the shots for whatever your rights are. And, of course, the way they try to do that at the local level, at the neighborhood level, is institute all these little public-private councils and community plans where the nature of how it is you live will be determined by those who were greedy enough for power to go to these little meetings every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights.
I understand those meetings are pretty tightly controlled. The Delphi technique and...
Well, they're tightly controlled until you go there and say, hey, take these strings off and let's talk about what's really going on. And when you do that, you end up with no consensus, and at best case, you've neutralized this whole dynamic that drives our neighborhoods, our churches, our schools, our planning departments into this dynamic of public-private partnerships. You go along, you get a cookie. If you don't, You don't know what you might end up with. But believe me, that cookie is, is the life for a human drone. It's not the life for a human being. And that's what's wrong with public-private partnerships.
And they always sell them very well. I mean, whether it's the visioning process or it's action for your neighborhood or whatever, that's always sounds so good. And if you get involved in your community and you find that you're hearing what we talk about on this program all the time, and you don't have our Understanding Sustainable Development Agenda 21, a guide for public officials, that will really help you see how this process works.
Well, and a lot of people have that guide. Many don't. Do recommend that you get it. But if you've seen the guide and you want more, there is plenty of tools that are made available through us. We didn't produce them all, but through us, there's just become a whole concrete chest of informational tools about Agenda 21 Sustainable Development, how it's in your community, how to recognize it, what to do about it. And, of course, all this is in somewhat an exploratory mode as America, county by county, begins to react to this federal infusion that seeks the domination of our communities themselves.
Don't you have a big DVD set that addresses all of this?
Well, we do. There's the six-hour, five presentation DVD called America's Choice: Liberty or Sustainable Development.
That's it.
And boy, you put that on community TV, you'll suddenly have some friends. There's a whole lot of people around America who know something's wrong and who would be quick to understand the dynamic that we describe. And if you get that word spread around your community, gee whiz, you'll suddenly have a nucleus. And boy, they knew it from the days of the revolution, and political activists have forever since known that it takes but a few dedicated people to change the course. And what we're looking for is a few dedicated people dedicated to the principles of the American ideals that incorporate the ideas of private property, that respect the sacrosanct nature of parenthood, and who demand a legitimate moral government. And boy, if we had a government that operated with the confines of the constitutional limitations that have been put upon government action, we wouldn't be here tonight. But unfortunately, we don't have a government that does that.
No, the jobs of government, one of the legitimate functions of government, is protection of rights. Individual rights, including and especially private property rights. Our government no longer does that. If anything, it does just the opposite.
Well, certainly the federal government makes that case. I mean, firstly, we have the president with his executive orders that pose a constant sword of Damocles above our necks. He has executive orders that allow him to do anything with our private property. We've seen evidence of it in many ways. We have a Supreme Court now that unanimously determines that there's no substantive due process requirement, not much of a substantive due process requirement when assessing Fifth Amendment taking claims. So, it's kind of what the local government says, according to the Supreme Court, unless they foul up with their own rules. Well, I thought the federal government existed to protect even the states, by way of the 14th Amendment. That certainly was the argument made for many decades, but now it's been abandoned. The federal government no longer protects us from violations of the Bill of Rights by states. So we don't look to the federal government, its executive. We can't look to the Supreme Court. And, of course, Congress is taking our money, sliding off a ton for the bureaucracy, and then sending it back to us with all these public-private partnership strings attached so that they can increase their own total control over the workplace and the child-rearing arrangements. More and more people, I do think, are beginning to see how the controls are becoming quite expansive, whether they're environmental regulatory controls or whether it's controls on how it is that you can get on an airplane. I mean, those rules are going to roll out here in the next year or so. So it's it becomes the march for the land of the free to become the home of the brave. And, you know, with the Nature Conservancy marching all over in partnership with the federal government, gathering up all the lands of America and around the world, we see signs of public-private partnership, and we also find that America's not the land of the free anymore. But we can reverse this, at least at this point in time, when those teeth grow bigger, it's going to become increasingly difficult to fight back the federal model. And wherever you are, the federal government is coming in wrongful ways into your community. Find those ways out. Oftentimes they're very silent about their little public-private partnership fundings coming into your community. But dig them out and surface them. You know, surface them through your radio. If you've got a newspaper that, you know, that is independent and isn't part of the left-right dialectic, you know, they might work with you. You know, make and distribute your own writings. Find others in the community. There are those who will know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's easy to find out. You can go to your local website. I know in Silicon Valley, the city of San Jose is a smart growth city. Tells you right there.
Right there. Yeah, most
you
of this
stuff.
You
can find this on Greenville's website. In fact, there's nothing really being hidden here. It's reported in the regular newspapers. You don't really have to look at the small weeklies to learn about smart growth.
And you know, so the mission for the average American is to find out what smart growth really is, and then be able to read his newspaper with an insight that needs to be spread around to your neighbors, etc. And then, boy, the resurrection of liberty in America could equal something that we could only dream about in our finest and best dreams, because it could be quite remarkable. But there's a lot to weed out of the process. There's a massive lack of respect for individuality and the individual rights that protect our individuality. And once we lop onto that, though, it'll be fun.
We probably ought to dwell on that individuality business a little bit more. It's often been thought, defended by writers, for such economists like Ludwig von Mises is an example, that the real battle is not between left versus right, whatever those are or were, but between individualism and collectivism. Individualism, that's that idea that is inherent in the Declaration of Independence, and then in rights to life, liberty, property rights, which are thought to be individual private property rights. And we've all gone collectivist. The collectivism is all about the group. It ratchets up the group in priority over the individual. So in practice, that means the individual doesn't own his own life, doesn't own the fruits of his own labor, or his own abilities, but his purpose is to serve the state or to serve the economy, serve the global economy.
Once you get to that point, his opinions aren't his own either, because opinions become very dangerous to have in a world such as what you're describing. Once the public partnership really takes its root.
They no longer teach logic anymore, and or basic reasoning in high schools.
Oh, and in the elementary school, it's all group, all team, all. There's really few, if any, individual type of exercises that you'll see. Even if you look at some of the stories that they read in the early grades, they're all about. You know, try to put a thought about, oh, no, you need to give up of yourself for the good of the neighborhood.
You know, they all make it warm and fuzzy sounding.
Yeah.
Well, that was, I think that Bill Gates' money to UNESCO is about creating books and those kinds of things for children.
Books that drive that point home,
right.
the group thought mentality. You know, last week I announced, quoted one of the Santa Cruz supervisors who, on the unanimous passage of a very onerous land use regulation, she said, oh, this has been wonderful. It shows the power of the group mind. Now, that was a pretty open explanation here in Santa Cruz from our government about what it is that you're supposed to do. You're to join that group mind and go along. And everything you have is for the all. That was a quote from Will Roberts in his analysis of Auguste Comte, the father of sociology. And here we are today sitting in a sociological scam that is bringing us havoc from all sides. And we just keep fighting the ghosts, but we need to recognize the core underpinnings of this a swath that's coming over us, and knowing and recognizing public-private partnerships could go a long way to clearing out the corruption that that is beginning to take root. Well, that was a silence. Well, if you've got a call and want to join into this conversation, call us at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Well, Steve, we've got a few minutes left in the show. Give us some final thoughts about this transformation from free enterprise into public-private partnership, and what people need to be aware of.
Some final thoughts, Let me see. God, where do I begin?
It's so big.
Yeah, well, this thing is big. That's one thing that comes to mind immediately, because I had no idea when I first began investigating this thing how large and encircling it really had grown. But I think that some people are catching on to it. You're one of the largest educational movements in the country is homeschooling. People are, it's mainly Christians, evangelical Christians, but it's not limited to them.
Oh, it's
our
it's
people
cool
are
everywhere.
Pulling their children out of government schools, which are emphasizing warm and fuzzy teamwork, everything for the good of the group, and school-to-work education, which is all about vocation, so they can someday have the job skills to work in a public-private partnership, workforce investment, and all of that. Parents are pulling their children out of these schools and educating them themselves. And when they can't do that, they'll find a private school. And more church-based private schools are turning up everywhere. I knew of some people starting one down in Columbia, and there's a prospect for starting a new private school here in Greenville. Although the plans are, it's basically in its infancy.
Well,
but there is a plan.
There are plenty of things that people can do, and depends upon your skill. And I always like what Roy says. It's just do something. Okay, now don't do something crazy or counterproductive. That's easy to do. Do something that fits your nature and that reflects your understanding of how the left-right divide is taking us right into a process of war, revolution, and terror. And so we don't want to play into those traps that are set by the political clever makers. What we want to do is stand for something that's right and do it straightforwardly. And if one of those things for you might be the education of young people, well, affiliate in some way or initiate in some way an educational program for children in your neighborhood that would benefit from such an undertaking. And while you've got some competitive disadvantages, if more and more of those kinds of responsive school situations were set up by ordinary people, the hue and cry from the parents who are having to pay twice, and from the parents who are forced with indoctrinating school dynamics, will make a call for state law changes. And the first state that makes that kind of reform is a state that many of us are going to want to live in. So gather up your own notion for how you can just push the dynamic forward a little bit in your town or in your state or in your field of endeavor, and help make freedom come out of the doldrums that it's found itself in the last
decade. Well, and learn. Take the time to learn. You know, you can learn on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website. You can learn from Stevie Yates' website. You can learn from, you know, there's a lot of people doing a lot of things across the country, and there's a lot of good information out there, solid, truthful information about what's going on, and where something strikes you is where you can go.
Well,
you can find pretty good stuff on the newswithviews.com website, we should note, and on Patrick Wood's
exactly
August Review site, and which contains material that's quite well referenced, by the way. He does write with footnotes to original sources, so everything is documented.
The truth is there to be learned.
Well, and that means that nobody has a reason not to know it. Some people will catch the gist of this just from hearing it, because you know, it just conforms to everything that they've seen around them for a long period of time. And other people, well, they're the doubting Thomases. They want to go down and look through that window, and the books are there, and the summary information is there, and now we're down to audio and video presentations that explain this stuff. And I haven't found anybody interested in challenging the thrust of what our message has been. And I want to thank you, Stephen, for your contributions to that.
I know
next week you're going to address the Mises Society down in Alabama on just this issue of public-private partnership. So, you know, I think we're working toward a dynamic where more and more people are writing on these subjects as well. And for every writer, there's a ton of readers if the writing's done well. And it's the word is spreading.
And what's coming up in the next hour?
Well, we're back with Stephen Yates, a replay.
He's so good, we got to have more.
And that subject's going to be discussing phony free trade. So stay with us and come back next week at the same time for the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Check out our website and just do something, huh, Roy?
That's right.
Okay, have a good week. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening. I'm your host tonight. My name is Michael Shaw for the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. It's great to be back here in the studio. I haven't been here since June, and I'm especially excited about our show tonight. We're going to talk about trade. You know, trade policy is what drives the world and has created empires and destroyed empires. It's allowed for free nations, and it's allowed for controlled nations. And America has been in the midst of massively shifting our historic trade policies into a new paradigm of trade policy. And both our hours tonight, we're going to talk about trade. We're going to talk about trade policies in the United States. And in the second hour, we're going to talk about trade policies in England. We're going to look at the comparisons between the trade policies and how they affect immigration and how they affect regionalization and really the political undoing of systems of government that have existed in England for 900 years and have been built in toward an advance of the human civilization and human condition, and then, of course, here in America for the last 225 years. The greatest achievement of mankind in all time, the application and declaration of independence with the principles that it rested upon. And here today, trade policies swarming the earth and coming straight out of Washington, D.C. and London are undoing all of that great effort in a very insidious way that is going to leave America, has begun to leave America, confused and distraught. And those circumstances are bound only to get worse if we don't come to understand the effect of trade policies and, in fact, what our trade policies are. So tonight, in our first hour, Doctor of Philosophy Stephen Yates is going to inform us as to the real effect and purpose of global trade agreements, including the recently enacted Central America Free Trade Agreement, otherwise known as CAFTA. Dr. Yates will explain how these phony free trade agreements are designed to undermine national sovereignty, establish regionalism, and feed the global governance monster while destroying the vision of the American experience. And Dr. Yates is a PhD and is probably the most published professional philosopher in South Carolina. He teaches, and in his words, is a lowly adjunct instructor of philosophy at the University of South Carolina. Now, the reason he describes himself that way is he says that it's an occupational punishment for his utter lack of political correctness. Now, he's the author of Civil Wrongs, What Went Wrong with Affirmative Action, and a new book that's just out, as I understand it, this week, called Worldviews, Christian Theism versus Modern Materialism. His articles and reviews have appeared on lewrockwell.com, as well as News with Views and other websites. He's published in academic journals, including Inquiry, Meta Philosophy, American Catholic Philosophical Quarterly, Reason Papers, Public Affairs Quarterly, Journal of Libertarian Studies, Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and others. He's been a fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and recently he spoke on the Real Matrix and Sustainable Development at the 6th Annual Freedom 21 Conference in Reno, Nevada. He comes to us from Greenville, North Carolina, and it is my pleasure to welcome to the audience Dr. Steve Yates. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am here, and I want to thank you for having me back on your show. It's good to be back.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and I'm really excited about talking with you on this subject. I know that just this month you had a very important and detailed essay printed at News with Views that describes what it is we're going to talk about tonight in some detail, how it is that America is being sold out with policies like the Central America Free Trade Agreement. We'll be right back here at Freedom 21. We're back at Freedom 21 on Santa Cruz Radio with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates. And, Stephen, where do we start with this whole issue of trade policy and so-called free trade agreements, et cetera?
Well, there's either of two places we could start. I could work under the assumption that everybody listening knows what CAFTA is, what it stands for. It stands for the Central American Free Trade Agreement. But because of that phrase, free trade, that's in there, there's a temptation there. It kind of puts people's brains to sleep because, to most economists anyway, free trade is supposed to be a good thing. And that's why a lot of mainstream economists backed CAFTA without really taking a close look at it.
Well, maybe then we need to start with what free trade really is and why free trade is good, and then look at these agreements and determine if, in fact, they represent ideas of free trade.
Okay. Suppose I've identified a need and I've produced an economic good or service that sets out to satisfy that need, that people want it and they're willing to pay for it. And for our purposes, it could, there's any number of things it could be. Suppose you want to trade with me. Suppose we agree on a reasonable price. Reasonable here is what you're willing to pay me, and as opposed to what I'm going to want for compensation. But suppose we agree on this. I offer the good, you offer me money and compensation for it. In other words, we trade. Each of us goes away satisfied.
Well, each of us presumably are benefiting, so we're talking about a circumstance of mutual benefit. And
correct.
Clearly, if we were to multiply that by the millions of transactions that people engage in every day, all to mutual benefit, working toward mutual benefit, there's a great rise to society's benefit as a result of that cumulative event.
Sure, that's the economy of economics of free enterprise on a large scale. But the point is, there's no coercion on either side. I produced the good or the service through my ingenuity. I identified the need. I undertook the specific actions necessary. You saw the good or as something of value to you, as something that would benefit you, and we traded. That, my friends, is free trade.
Well, we're going to have our audience from other stations returning with us here shortly. So hold with us for just a minute. We'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show and discussing with Stephen Yates the concept of free trade. And as he explains it, it's working toward mutual benefit by trading things between ourselves, all working toward a rise in society generally, all based upon free enterprise and non-coercive interaction and exchange between people. Now, this is the idea of free trade, and of course, if we're trading past national borders, we get into the issue of a nation's trade policy.
Yeah.
And explain to the listeners why it is that protectionism can be harmful, that those things that preclude free trade on a extra national basis can be harmful to the residents of the nation that actually deploys protectionist policies.
Well, they can be harmful in the sense that by imposing tariffs or other kinds of restrictions on trade, you just at a very basic level, you're preventing people from achieving benefits that they want, and they would come to resent this. So, as Bastiat puts it, that's a good way of saying this: that when goods cross borders, armies don't. So, there you are.
And, of course, that's all presuming that the trade that is crossing borders is determined by those who are trading and not by those who are managing the trade.
Yes, exactly. Now, if we take this conception of free trade that I cashed out, really the next thing to do is to set out to compare these trade agreements, these big, massive accords that we're dealing with now, with that definition and see if they qualify.
Now, they call themselves free trade.
They call themselves that, but really anybody can use a phrase. Now, part of my argument against CAFTA is that it does not qualify as a free trade agreement. It qualifies as a managed trade agreement. If we want free trade with Canada and Mexico, well, thinking of NAFTA just for a minute, because the list of countries is shorter.
Now, NAFTA is the North American
Free Trade Agreement. Sure. But if we want free trade between Canadians, Mexicans, and Americans, all we need to say is there shall be no governmental interference between open and free trade between Americans, Canadians, and Mexicans. NAFTA, on the other hand, was thousands of pages long.
And why does it take thousands of pages to say that people here and people there can trade without the interference of government?
Oh, because those thousands of pages were necessary to throw in all of the regulations, because NAFTA, again, is about managed trade. It's not really free trade. And CAFTA expands NAFTA. It's based on the same model that managed trade that NAFTA was based on.
And now, is it possible, in your view, to have free enterprise and managed trade at the same time?
Not really, because the one will push the other one out. You'll have kind of had Gresham's law of bad money pushes out good, or it's the equivalent of it. Bad trade pushes out good trade.
It's my understanding that these global free trade agreements have effects on more than simple trading dynamics. They tend to promote immigration policies or the blurring of boundaries by bringing people, giving them free access to cross the borders in order to implement the managed trade policies. And it tends also to regionalize, have regionalizing aspects to its provisions. Is that true, where we get political regions that grow out of these free trade agreements?
Yes. I think you could argue that CAFTA, it's useful to focus on CAFTA just because it's the most recent, is about a lot of things that have nothing to do with trade, per se. All you need to do to recognize this is read CAFTA's own preamble, and it's online. Now, the very first thing, once it's listed, the parties that are the parties to the trade accord, all you have to do is read down the list of what CAFTA sets out to do. For example, the first one: strengthen the special bonds of friendship and cooperation among their nations and promote regional economic integration.
Well, now, what does that mean, perchance?
Well, special bonds of friendship and cooperation, it's kind of vague. It could mean any number of things. I think President Bush has described things like propping up these fledgling democracies and things like that. Now, unfortunately, nothing in our Constitution obligates our government to do that.
Well, what bothers me about that kind of language, we see this in the sustainable development nomenclature everywhere, is that fine and fuzzy words are used that have no meaning other than the meaning that somebody applies to them at a later period of time. So we've got now government officials vested with authority under CAFTA to do these nebulous pursuits that end up being defined any way that the center power chooses it to be utilized.
Well, certainly. Now, the various chapters in CAFTA illustrate this. They different chapters create different regional international bureaucracies or tribunals, to use the term that they frequently use. And we could turn our attention to looking at the same statement still. Those four words: promote regional economic integration.
Now, that's really a political statement. I mean, there's no way they can fuzz that as a purely trade dynamic.
Well, no, because it's just focusing on the economic. The idea of an unregulated economic situation just hasn't been on anybody's radar screen since the 1930s, and even before then. The whole Keynesian conception of the economy is of a government micromanaged economy, priming the pumps. They loved that phrase. So my point here, if you're going to promote regional economic integration, is going to necessarily lead to regional political integration as well. And that's why so many of us are seeing red flags on this about the New World Order, about regional government, and threats to American independence, U.S. sovereignty, because CAFTA certainly does that. So did NAFTA, so did the World Trade Organization. But CAFTA is taking it to the next level, and the FTAA, the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is the next thing on the horizon, takes this thing really to the next level.
And that level is?
Western Hemispheric Government.
Western Hemispheric Government.
Because it talks about the regional integration, economic integration of not six nations or seven or eight, but 34. All of the Western Hemispheric nations except for Cuba.
Well, and we certainly have to see a pattern for this. In our next hour, we're going to talk with Englander, Dr. David Abbott, about how the European Union, originally the European Common Market, a so-called economic arrangement for free trade, has evolved into the European Union, which is a total political amalgamation of all of Europe, sucking England in at the same time. And so they're ahead of us in this process, but we can see the same pattern of continental or hemispheric integration of all countries under common rules that come out through global governance organizations. And that, in effect, is what these trade agreements seem to be doing, because 1,200 pages per agreement covering all aspects of human life tend to bring us to that point quite clearly, if one pauses to look. And, of course, we're not reminded of this by any major media news source. We don't hear anything about these trade policies, and nations are made and broken, and empires are created through trade policy, and lives and lifestyles and standards of living and freedom and private property and all of that are dependent upon the nature of the monetary policy, the trade policy, and the foreign policy of a country. And it seems to me that these three concepts of policy, as administered by our federal government, Democrat or Republican led, are all leading us to the same end, and that is the erasure of our borders and the changing of our laws to meet this centralized global order's demands.
Sure. Now, got less expertise on the development of the European Union probably than your next guest, but my understanding is that the European Union was originally sold to Europeans. There was the same behind-the-scenes maneuvering, but it was sold out as a free trade zone. Now they've lost the individual nations have lost their currency, and for all practical purposes, their sovereignty is gone. Some of them are, like France is an example, and the Netherlands is another example, are trying to do some fast backpedaling, but it may be too late.
Well, I think Tony Blair is doing fast backpedaling as well, because, you know, what I think the globalists learned by their European experience is that people don't take to these trade agreements when they understand them. And that's starting to show itself in Europe. And if Europeans can figure out these trade programs don't make sense, there's no reason Americans shouldn't. But that's why the administration, Washington, D.C., and the controlled media are so quiet about the real nature of these trade agreements, which have no bearing on historical American values and perspectives, and in fact are going to destroy the ideals which we depend on for having a life that is our own. We're going to break here again in a few seconds for a couple minute break, and we'll be back with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates. Well, we're back here at Freedom 21. We're going to work through this commercial break while some of our radio stations are away from us. And as we do that, you know, the stories sometimes from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio can sound ominous. And certainly the American people, and in fact humanity itself, has its back against the wall, against this massively organized and funded thrust for creating global governance. But it is not as bleak as it may seem at the moment, because many people, many organizations are sprouting up that are seeing the broader picture, focusing on specific issues, and an awakening is on the horizon. And we'll point out a couple of tools that are available to you and for use in your neighborhood, because those The truth is something that can come out and is coming out. For instance, the DVD ROM called Taking Liberty, Understanding the Wildlands Project, put together by Dr. Michael Kaufman, a prior guest on this show, and the Stewards of the Range, the organization headed by Wayne Hage, another person who's made a great contribution to this radio show. Those interviews are available in our archives at F21SC/radio, and you can hear these prior interviews. But this DVD-ROM shows how the Wildlands Project is moving across our ranches, has gone across our forests, is now chewing up our farms, is taking our rural residents and putting squeezes, regulatory squeezes on them. It's shutting down our rural communities and forcing people into the smart growth zones where privately financed, government-controlled housing is on rampant pace for development in this country. That's something that's a half-hour segment that shows the endangered species and critical habitat and all the techniques being used, conservation easements, etc. All of the techniques that are being used by our federal government and state government to swallow up our land and put it under the control of central forces and corporate governance, socialist corporate organizations like the Nature Conservancy. Also, boy, the standby guide called Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, a guide for public officials, that costs $2.50 a copy. It's less than that, bought in bulk. But you read this, a short booklet, and you'll understand sustainable development. You give it to your public officials, and they'll be held accountable for dealing with the terrible consequences that are coming to our country via sustainable development policies. And you can spread it to your friends and neighbors. It's just a tremendous tool. And then, of course, too, there's the America's Choice, a six-hour DVD, 5 one-hour segments, plus some extra from distinguished speakers from around the country. Liberty or Sustainable Development, America's Choice, a DVD. You can order any of these items in many places, but including Freedom21SantaCruz.net. Go to our store online. And then finally, a new product from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, the 8-hour CD version of The War on Reason, conducted in June of this year with people like Dr. Karen Efron of the of EdWatch and Dr. Edwin Vieira on central banking and the sustainable world order and other great interviews. So check out the store at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz for these products and others, and get yourself informed, get your neighborhood informed. This is a global to local program, and we've got to strike back at the local level because that's where it comes right at us. So we're going to return with our regular audience here in just a few seconds, and we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Stephen Yates. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates, and let's just pick up from before the break, Steve.
Okay, you mentioned sustainable development. It's worth noting, useful to note, that sustainable development and all that it's involved in that term is pulled right into CAFTA without even leaving the preamble. Well, let me just read this statement. One of the aims of CAFTA to implement this agreement in a manner consistent with environmental protection and conservation, promote sustainable development, and strengthen their cooperation on environmental matters. So there you are. Sustainable development, little case S, little case D, is kind of stuck there in the middle where if you're not paying close attention, you might not see it. But, of course, that phrase is pregnant with an enormous agenda. Well, Agenda 21 is pulled into this trade accord, which is obviously far more than a trade accord at this point.
And yet you still find, politicians who are in the know on this, I think, who always like to say, oh, Agenda 21, that's a conspiracy theory. And yet you go to the website, go to the web and put in Agenda 21 or Sustainable Development, and you'll end up at the UN page that is entitled Sustainable Development Agenda 21. And you then can go to any federal agency and you can find Sustainable Development Agenda 21 references everywhere. And, of course, it is Agenda 21 policy that is driving domestic policy, driving our foreign policy, driving our trade policy, and these free trade agreements. It is all Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is the remake of the world in the image of central power. Central power held by people who are unelected, even unviewed by the public. So it used to sound like a horrible nightmare, and today it is an easily documented fact. And how it is that the Democrat Party through the Democrat Leadership Council and the Republican Party through the International Democrat Union. Now, if you've not heard of that before, you need to check out IDU.org, International Democrat Union, which shows the GOP committed to an international organization that has as its purpose the implementation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And, of course, that means the eradication of the inalienable right principles of the Declaration of Independence. This is the war of all time. It's not being fought with guns. It's being fought with trade agreements, legislation, bills, and other shenanigans that D.C. is deeply enmeshed in all the time. All three branches of government, you know, the direction of the country is simply wrongly aimed. So, Steve,
it's a war. It's being fought with language as well, because you've got these nice, as you put it, warm and fuzzy sounding phrases. You've got phrases like free trade itself that are used in ways that would have jolted even Orwell, and things like that. And if you try to actually sit down and read a trade accord like CAFTA, your eyes are going to glaze over rather fast. I can't figure out who they drafted to write that bureaucratese.
Well, I tell you, you know, it seems to me they've got a lot of people being paid to do that. And while it may read, it may be a very boring read, they have reasons for these words, for their meanings and their non-meanings.
Well, it's selected very carefully.
Very carefully.
I believe that.
Yes.
I just love it when somebody calls me a conspiracy theorist or something like that. Well, for one thing, it's not a theory. As you noted, this is very easy to document, and it's getting easier all the time because these people have these large documents. Agenda 21 is a perfect example. They're right there on their websites. They are not hiding anymore. Assuming they were at one time, they're very open about what it is they're doing. CAFTA is right there on its own website. And if you're reading down further in the preamble, it says very openly, the very last line on the preamble of aims of CAFTA, contribute to hemispheric integration and provide an impetus toward establishing the free trade area of the Americas. So there you are. It's a stepping stone to the free trade of the Americas, the FTAA.
So going from 8 countries to 34.
Anybody who denies that, you can point them to that line in CAFTA. Either they are ignorant or they are lying. Simple as that.
If you have a question or comment for Dr. Yates, you can call us at the Radio Liberty Network here at 888-245-4237. That's 888-24-LIBERTY. Steve, some people will argue that these trade agreements bring jobs to America. We've got about 20 seconds till we cut to our next break, but can you give us some introduction on how we might deal with that as we come back from break?
Okay, well, nobody said that it created no jobs at all, but the point is, has there been any kind of a balance between job
creation? Hold that thought, Steve. We'll be right back.
Oh, okay.
We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Network. We're going to continue to talk with our guest, Dr. Stephen Yates, while some stations break away. And what we're talking about is the job effects, domestic job effects, of these trade agreements.
Oh, sure. There were a few jobs created back with NAFTA, for example. But in my state, anyway, South Carolina, North Carolina, too, there have been thousands of textile mills closed. There have been tens of thousands of jobs lost all across this country. and many of these jobs paid reasonably well. This was the sort of thing that had built up the middle class in these regions. They were replaced by these low-paying service sector jobs. Sometimes they're called Mick jobs, hamburger flipper type jobs, paper pusher jobs, things like that, that really pay very poorly.
And the loss, of course, is of the manufacturing jobs that move toward cheaper labor sources that are advantaged through these free trade agreements.
Yes, and they moved to Mexico.
Pony trade agreements.
And now it's interesting to note that with CAFTA, some of the Mexicans themselves are worried that the jobs are going to go to Central America. We'll just have to watch and wait and see.
Okay, now we have a caller, Susan from Corralitos. Hello, Susan. Are you there?
Yeah.
Hello.
Good evening. Dr. Yates, it's a pleasure to be able to ask you my question.
Oh, thank you.
You talked about hemispheric integration a couple of times.
Yes.
And I know that Simón Bolívar had the idea that the Western Hemisphere could be integrated in 1833. And that this idea has been around for a long time. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about the governmental structure that they might use. I suspect the Organization of American States and or the Summit of the Americas is going to be the vehicle that they use for the supranational government. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Okay, well, I'm more familiar with the Summit of the Americas that came about in 1994, and the FTAA is their brainchild, their baby, so to speak. So they would build it up that way. They would also build it up through, very likely, the WTO, the World Trade Organization.
And we're going to return with the rest of our audience right now. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm here with Dr. Stephen Yates, and we have a call from Susan, who has asked Dr. Yates about the political integration of the hemisphere under these concepts, and Dr. Yates is responding with is giving us a response to that.
Okay, I mentioned the Summit of the Americas, 1994, and I began to mention the World Trade Organization, which is for all practical purposes a branch of the UN. So the UN, which United Nations, which has long seen itself as an emerging world government, although they don't call it that anymore. They speak now of global governance. But you're talking about the gradual migration of concentrations of power to these international level bureaucracies where people are not elected and therefore don't answer to the American people or the people of these other nations. And it's not just Americans that are worried about this whole thing.
Yeah, I think in Central America and many South American countries, Ecuador and Venezuela are actively defying the United States on this hemispheric integration right now.
Well, Costa Rica, they're also very, very antsy about it. Now, I have an article here. It was sent to me just today about somebody in Costa Rica. Now, I could just read at least a little of this because it's new material. It just found its way into my hands today. This is from someone in Costa Rica who opposes CAFTA, who thinks it's a bad idea. Let's see, Bolivar Elizondo barely ekes out a living on his 25-acre farm in the mountains, where he raises chickens, pigs, pineapples, and a dozen cows. But his biggest worry these days is a free trade agreement with the United States. A man who must do everything by hand with a machete or knife. He depends on selling about 50 pigs a year to finance the rest of his tiny operation. He says he could never compete with the large mechanized meat producers from the United States that are expected to invade the market over the next 20 years if Costa Rica's legislature approves the accord. Of course, they're talking about CAFTA here. without selling the pigs, I don't know how to survive. He said, is he fed his pigs? I can't support myself. I will have to sell this. Who is going to buy it? Not another Costa Rican. It will be a multinational corporation. Now, from there on, it goes on with a description of the Central American Free Trade Agreement that should be familiar to all of us. But it's not just Americans that are worried about this. There's Latinos and Hispanics that are worried about it too. And it's interesting. It's the same fundamental dichotomy. The people pushing these trade accords are always the elites, the powerful, the people at the top or upper echelons of government, the banking establishment, and at the establishments at the top of the multinational corporations.
Well, there's
the ones that are going to benefit.
Well, there's one other group that we can't forget, because we all live in a community and we say, well, those elites aren't in my community. But what we have in each of our community are what I call sustainable mercenaries, folks who receive the dollars that get funneled down through the elite, you know, the recycling of our tax dollars, the massive amounts of capital that the NGOs have, and the multinational corporations, who then work either through business or through government or through NGO activity at the local level to hand out all these little goodies to get all of the opportunists or the gullible people to do their dirty work for them. In the meantime, the rest of us try to raise our children, run our businesses, and lead our lives, and we find that day by day our liberties are being encroached. And I think more and more people are beginning to understand that sustainable development is about creating a global police state. And no one, I don't care if you're rich or poor, Mexican, American, Canadian, or Chilean, nobody wants to advance toward that condition. And yet, we're so far down the road of having our infrastructure created for this this permanent revolution and the global state that goes with it, that we're going to have to do some heady thinking on how to transition ourselves out and away, and that's why I always say we need to, you know, redirect our leadership in this country, because if America pulls out of this tailspin and gets out of this global trade nonsense and restores the idea of genuine free trade, boy, a renaissance around the world that is unimaginable today will follow, because the people of the world will follow the country that stands for the principle that liberty matters. And Susan,
I had one more question for Dr. Yates, if there's time.
Sure is. Go ahead.
Well, he talked about the Summit of the Americas, and Dr. Yates, you said it's mostly a bureaucratic organization, and it's really curious to know. I'm not quite sure who attends the Summit of the Americas. It's certainly not Congress, and yet Congress is quite willing to sign these agreements that give their authority to bureaucrats who attend the Summit of the Americas to make all these deals that are directing what is effectively our foreign policy. Why would they do that? It means that they're giving away their power. I can't see, when I look at our Congress, I don't look at people like that they're doing this. Do they know they're giving away their power, or are they? Why? I don't understand the motivation for it.
Yeah, that's it sounds really paradoxical, because you think about it: is your congressman really going to vote away his own power?
Right.
I understand that. If I am understanding your question right, now I think the answer can be found in just looking at the way CAFTA was passed that night in the House, with all the arm twisting that was going on within, and particularly all the deal cutting that was going on. Now, you're talking about, when you talk about Congress, you talk about the political animal generally, you're talking about a fundamentally utilitarian creature. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Seems to be the prevailing ethic in Congress these days. So why did these people vote for CAFTA, when their constituents didn't want them to, and when they themselves had said they would say no to CAFTA, and when they have been informed, at least in South Carolina anyway, by those of us who claim that they are selling out American sovereignty by doing so, why would they vote for it anyway?
Yeah.
Because somebody cut them a deal. offered, including offered protectionist type of measures to textile mills here in the Carolinas. That was done. Other things were done, and millions worth of public works
mm-hmm.
were promised to House members in various places around the country. William Jasper has a new article on this in a forthcoming issue of the New American, describing some of the back of the room, smoke filled room type deals
right.
that went on. But I think if you keep in mind that you're dealing with a utilitarian, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine mm-hmm. kind of mindset, you can explain why members of Congress would vote to sell out this country this way.
You know, and I think we can't forget the fact that both parties, Republican and Democrat, are sustainability parties.
No doubt about it.
I'm not
distinguishing Democrat from Republican here. We may as well just speak of the Washington Party.
But my point
the
there would be...
Sustainability Party, if you prefer.
You know, if you're an elected politician, Democrat or Republican, and you don't go along with the sustainability program, you will not get your funding. So when we talk about giving away your power, the only way they get their power is from these internationalist political parties in this country. And if you don't go with the internationalist theme and keep quiet about it at the same time, you simply aren't going to get party money. You'll no longer be in Congress. So I think that the people that we have in Congress today are people who are committed to being in Congress, even if it means selling out the United States, because, after all, that's what their parties are telling them to do.
Well, Dr. Gates, thank you very much for your very informed statements on the CAFTA, and I appreciate getting a chance to ask my questions.
Well, sure. Thank you for calling, Susan. Mm-hmm. Stephen, we've got about 15 minutes or so, and let's talk about CAFTA in terms of we've talked about job dynamics, but there's the issue of the constitutionality of it and what effect it has on sovereignty, and what else do you see, and how would you explain those issues related to the trade policies that we're adopting in this country?
Well, under the question of CAFTA's unconstitutionality is actually quite easy. I mean, Article 1, Section 3, I think it is, or Section 8, Paragraph 3, excuse me, requires that Congress regulate trade with foreign nations. And further on in the Constitution, Article 6, I think it is, designates or specifies that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. There is nothing there that authorizes Congress to delegate or outsource its constitutional requirement.
And how does CAFTA, international
organization?
Okay. So you're saying CAFTA outsources trade policy from Congress to the World Trade Organization?
To the World Trade Organization, and more specifically to any number of international tribunals and international bureaucracies that are created by the various chapters in CAFTA. And in the article on newswithviews.com, which you mentioned earlier in the hour, I've enumerated a number of those and provided links where anyone so inclined can check these for himself or herself.
And we have that article posted at the freedom21santacruz.net/radio page. So you can read those details. They're quite compelling, I must say. What is it that these trade agreements do to American sovereignty? I mean, you've established some element of its lack of constitutionality. There may be something more you want to say there, but I certainly don't want to miss the issue of trade policy's effect on national sovereignty.
Well, we've covered that somewhat when we were talking about regional economic integration. The only thing really useful to add there is, if I can't remember if I said it or not, that you don't really have economic integration without also bringing in regional political integration, given that the idea of an unregulated, unmicromanaged economy hasn't been on anybody's radar screens, for anybody in power anyway, excuse me, hasn't been on their radar screens in over 75 years, not since the Keynesians took over. So when it says at the end here, contribute to hemispheric integration and provide an impetus toward establishing the free trade area of the Americas, the best thing I can recommend people do is go to that particular website and start reading the FTAA. And you will quickly come to realize, if you study it, that if the FTAA becomes passed, then U.S. sovereignty is history, because there are provisions there that would supersede any federal, state, national laws. The bureaucracies could overrule them.
Wow. Well, I have a quote that I got from you in your article from Vicente Fox in 2002. He said, eventually our long-range objective is to establish with the United States, but also with Canada, our regional partner, an ensemble of connections and institutions similar to those created by the European Union, with the goal of attending to future themes such as the future prosperity of North America and the movement of capital, goods, services, and persons. So that's a pretty clear indication from the President of Mexico of what the intent of these trade agreements and regional policies is to be. It's the amalgamation of North America into one country, presumably with ultimately one currency, just as happened in Europe.
Oh, sure. Vicente Fox is a globalist. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And it's interesting that that you mentioned that. He made that statement in Madrid. Now, there has been a document that just appeared within the last 2 or 3 months. I'm not sure just when it appeared. It first came to my attention about 6 weeks ago. It's on the website of the shadowy Council on Foreign Relations, which is often spoken of in this context. But the title of this 59-page document is Building a North American Community. It's the product of, they call themselves, an independent task force sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations with the Canadian Council of Chief Executives and the, going to pronounce this right, Consejo Mexicano de Asuntos Internacionales, which is the Mexican equivalent.
Now, what role does the United States have in this? As I understand it, that's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. What role does the U.S. have in this?
Well, the U.S. would be submerged into the larger megastate, which would include Mexico and Canada. And it's interesting that these were the three NAFTA nations. How long will it be before they pull in the six CAFTA countries into this rapidly expanding megastate? And here, again, people say this is a conspiracy theory. There it is. They're not hiding. There's no conspiracy here, and it's as much a fact as gravity. There it is on the website.
And we
anybody can download it and read it for himself.
And we've got this document also posted at our radio page, so you can go into that and review this document as well. We have Lorna from Idaho on the line. Lorna, do you have a question for Dr. Yates?
Yes. By the way, I've been on the Summit of the Americas website, and it is quite amazing, the hemispheric integration with, I think it's, what, 32 or 23 other countries or something?
34.
Oh, is it? Yeah. And, I mean, it's not only UNESCO, it's sustainable development, I mean, everything. But my question is the charter that we signed on September 11th that Colin Powell signed for the Organization of the Americas, what impact does that have on us?
Let's see, what is the name of that document?
It's the charter that we signed for the Organization of the Americas.
Okay, I'm less familiar with that.
If you go into the website and you go into the partners, and it's the Organization of the Americas, and it was signed on 2001, September 11th, when we got bombed, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
It's very interesting. There's always...
Now, of course, there are so many of these documents in existence now.
This is the point
where it's impossible to keep track of them all.
We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show in just a moment. I'm back here while some stations break, continuing our discussion with Dr. Stephen Yates on CAFTA and trade agreements in the United States. Thank you very much, Lorna, for your call to the show tonight. Dr. Yates, is it true that the free trade policies are, these phony free trade policies are always involving partners? It seems that wherever you go now in terms of economic talk, it's always about partners. It's the partnership between America and Mexico and Canada. It's the partnership between the federal government and your local school board. It's the partnership between your local home builder and the local planning department and the federal agency that's funding them. It's all about partners. There's no talk any longer about free enterprise and the protection of private property. It seems to me that all these trade notions just really solidify this idea of partnership. And of course, Mussolini never used the word partner, but it's really the same economic system, is it not?
Well, yes, basically. It's kind of a corporatist kind of system. And Mussolini once said that corporatism was a better term for what he believed than fascism, because corporatism combines, I forget the exact words, combines the economic resources of business with the power of government to get things done. If you combine corporate power with government power, that's the definition of a public-private partnership. Partnering, you're right. That's the buzzword of the day. Everybody is partnering with everybody else, and it's one grand collectivist kind of system.
You know, it's tough to partner with the agent of force. You know, they used to when I was a boy, when the government got in bed with partners looking to sign to seal their own pocket, it was called the mob. You know, and today we've legitimized mob type actions by legitimizing the idea that the force of government can partner with their friends, and that's how we end up with the kinds of eminent domain decisions that came down earlier in the summer, and even some worser decisions that came down before that. And for those who don't know what I'm referring to there, it's the Lingle versus Chevron Supreme Court case, which unanimously held that due process requirements in property cases was to be a very low standard. In other words, whatever the government wants, the government, local government gets, which allows for this unlimited formation of partnerships at the local level. And boy, there's no easier way to describe tyranny than what happened in Italy as a result from that economic experiment back in the 30s and 40s. We're going to welcome our audience back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station just now. Welcome back to our concluding minutes here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station in our interview with Dr. Stephen Yates on the question of the phony free trade agreements that are selling America down, down, down. You know, one question that I have we didn't cover earlier, and that is the issue of how it is we get these trade agreements passed by simple majority votes, when one would think an international trade agreement would have something to do with a treaty provision as opposed to a standard bill. Is that
true?
Well,
they call it agreement. They call it an agreement rather than a treaty in order to circumvent the constitutional requirement that a treaty be signed by, I think, two-thirds of the Senate. A simple majority can sign and pass an agreement. So, again, as I said earlier, this is as much a war of words as it is anything else.
Well, we see that kind of manipulation right here in Santa Cruz, where it's clear that to impose certain taxes, two-third requirements are imposed, and yet, you know, water districts will go impose a water tax and sometimes do it without even a vote, and always claiming that they only need a 50% majority. We also have Roger on the phone from Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for us this evening?
Yeah, thanks, gents. I guess you're just about out of time, but there's an unfortunately unnecessary manner in which I think we kind of lost the CAFTA debate because it wasn't much intellectually robust. I don't know if that's going to be the swaying factor, but, you know, on the one hand, you had Pat Buchanan casting raw protectionism rather than tariffs for revenues. I think that's a big mistake, or an alternate to the income tax, or one that's very attractive. On the other hand, you got, like, Coalition for Fair Trade. That's the code word for your stock liberal type of arguments, and there I am spitting nails with a local radio show having this guy on against it. I'm thinking, that's what I had to go by. I might have been for CAFTA. But on my point was on the, and I hope you revisit this soon, because it's on the outright lies of the pro-CAFTA forces, because they really, they just pretend to use the libertarian stream arguments, but then they only selectively appropriate, and then they won't allow natural market corrections to take place, but instead it's IMF bailouts to facilitate their so-called free trade. And the brilliant libertarian stream folks point out, you know, that if you wanted to have true free trade, all you need is 2-3 pages, but if you want to have a trade protection racket for the well-connected, then you need 2,400-some pages to pull that off.
Yes, I agree completely.
Well, you know, there's an element within the libertarian group that has really led us into this abyss.
And I disagree with some of the arguments myself. It's just that some of them are very good, but we can just prove that they're liars on their basic premise.
If we stick to the premise,
they're liars on that basic premise, that they merely pretend to be a libertarian stream of borrowers, but they're really not.
I'd say precisely right. And on the other hand, you've got the Green Party and their land use movement, and it's nothing but a land grab for corporate socialist benefits, and it's nothing to do with the protection of anything that the local folks are interested in having protected. It's about amalgamating power, centralizing it, and moving forward that way. Roger, we want to thank you very much for your call. We're about out of time here, and I want to thank Dr. Yates for being with us. I want to, you have a book. While we end up here, can you tell us about the book and how people might avail themselves of that book?
Yeah, the book is kind of on a different subject. Of course, trade agreements are not my only obsession, but I should note that they're in connection with the earlier gentleman's call, that there are people who opposed CAFTA for the wrong reason, because they saw that it's not socialist enough.
We're going to run out of time here, but that was certainly Congressman Sam Farr here in the coast of California. But you can check our website for more information on Dr. Yates, and you can get his book, and we'll go forward from there.
You could get the book from exlibris.com.